The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Glenn Beck Program. The president has just left the pontiff. He was in Rome. They exchanged books and exchanged gifts. Now, the last president we had, remember his first tour? Oh, man. Remember he gave the queen a DVD, which she couldn't use in England, of all of his greatest speeches? I mean, we all are pretty sure that Donald Trump thinks highly of himself. Even Donald Trump didn't give as a gift all of his greatest hits. So what did he give the Pope, and what did the Pope give him? Meeting with the Pontiff. We begin there right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
So they get together, they exchange gifts. I mean, what do you get the Pope? I mean, a guy who literally has everything. Oh, you got me a nice little statue. Good, thank you. I'll put that over in my desk right next to the Michelangelo. I mean, what do you get that guy who has everything, including his own face on bottle openers?
It's fine. I
thought better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
When you hear, you may not think better when you hear what the Pope gave to Donald Trump.
Because it's not only a guy who has everything, but also a guy who is outwardly telling you that material things don't matter.
Correct.
So, yeah, like, right, where do you right. go?
That's when you just walk in and you're like, hey,
I got nothing.
I
got
you. Pope. I just was thinking about you, and I thought, you know what? You don't want any material things. So I bought a little something for myself. Okay. So Donald Trump gave him a case of books from Martin Luther King, and the Pope gave Donald Trump a medal by a Roman artist that said that what that was an olive. I mean, when a Roman artist is making something for the president of the United States, you wonder, yeah, then how come it looks like a pile of crap? No, it's an olive. But he gave him an olive, a symbol of peace, and apparently the president said we can use peace. The Pope also gave him three books, the topics of family, the joy of the gospel, and the care of our common home, the environment. Mm. He then gave him, and this is what it's going to set Pat off, look out. He's going to be screaming to the Pope, get off my lawn. He also gave him his encyclical on climate change. So hopefully that'll...
Oh, man.
Hopefully that'll help Donald Trump, you know, understand.
Yeah.
We got to do something on climate change.
And not just something. We need to spend, well, according to the Al Gore group, $15 trillion. And according to that other group, 90 trillion, was it?
Just the 90 trillion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Paul Kangor is with us. He is the author of a new book called The Pope and a President, A Pope and a President. It's an amazing book. If you love Ronald Reagan, you have to buy this book and read it. A Pope and a President, Ronald Reagan and his relationship with Pope John Paul. Paul, welcome to the program. How are you, sir?
Hey, good guys. Great to be with you.
Good. So what are your thoughts on the visit with Donald Trump and the Pope?
Well, you know, I was first struck at just how different this is from Ronald Reagan and John Paul II, right? I mean, you know, to have with those two when they first met, which was ironically 35 years ago, almost to this exact week when the two of them met at the Vatican for the first time. Yeah, that was June 1982. And, you know, those two went in with all sorts of commonalities. I mean, they agreed on the international situation, the domestic situation. They both had been, you know, shot the year before and both, you know, miraculously survived these assassination attempts.
They both agreed clearly on the definition of evil as well.
They did. And to both of them, you know, the one clear international global threat was atheistic Soviet communism. And these two as well, with Francis and Trump, you know, they might agree that the dominant international threat is Islam or radical Islam, but they don't in any way, I think, share any sort of common mission on how to respond to it.
Do you think that the Pope, where have you gotten that the Pope really understands radical Islam? I mean, he seems to almost be towing the same line that you would hear from CNN.
Right, right. Yeah, he's been very, let's say, merciful, right, which is a common word
right.
of his, being the sort of the Pope of mercy. He's been very charitable and merciful toward Islam. But I think, you know, if pressed, and I think he and Trump, from what I could tell so far and what I've read about the meeting, I think they agreed, at least on the threat of Islam in terms of religious persecution, because that seems to be an issue that was brought up in at the Vatican between the two of them. But I think the difference, Glenn, is how would they respond to it, right? And, you know, how would they talk about it publicly? You're never going to have Pope Francis condemning radical Islam in the way that Trump did or the way that Trump has, or referring to it in the kind of incendiary language that Trump has. But I think, so the difference is probably not necessarily in how they recognize the threat, but how they respond to it.
So we're talking to Dr. Paul Kangor. He's the author of A Pope and a President, The Meeting Between John Paul and the Friendship Between John Paul and Ronald Reagan. Here we have the guy who is probably the biggest, he's almost a caricature of capitalism. And to somebody like Pope Francis, who grew up in South America, who is not favorable to capitalists at all, he must view Donald Trump as everything that he stands against. And I just can't imagine. What do you think the Pope was? What do you think the Pope's message to him was privately?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know if they talked about that at all. I mean, the actual statement that came out from the Vatican, I'm looking at it right now. Boy, it's not even maybe 100 or 200 words long. So there's hardly anything to it at all. And it says that they talked really about common areas of agreement, such as it says, a commitment in favor of life. That would be unborn human life, I would think. Freedom of worship, freedom of conscience. And it also says that areas, I think it says that they brought up immigration. They talked about the Middle East, the protection of Christian communities. So I don't think he brought up any of his sort of what's seen as, you know, anti-capitalist viewpoints from Pope Francis. I doubt they really talked economics much. I doubt they talked climate change much. But as you guys mentioned, Glenn, that encyclical, it's called Laudato Si, that addresses all of those topics. So when he gave that to Trump and two other statements, and Trump actually said, I'll read these, which is impressive for Trump, because the guy hardly reads anything, right? I mean, he said he doesn't read books. They're not quite book length, but I think Laudato Si is maybe, off the top of my head, 50 to 70 pages. So, you know, it's a pretty in-depth read, but it talks about economics, climate change, but also talks about family. It talks about how if we're going to care for God's creation, we need to not just care about the environment, we need to care about God's creation of the little ones in the womb, for example. So there's still, I mean, they have some pretty obvious areas of disagreement, but they also have some pretty important commonalities that I think people aren't giving them credit for.
Is this something, as Donald Trump, does anybody know, has Donald Trump ever met with a pope before? I mean, I'm just wondering,
was this
something that was, do you think, that was moving or special to him in any way? As a guy who's done everything he's wanted for his whole life?
Yeah, I think it was. And in fact, the CNN headline on this was very interesting. At CNN.com, I think the title was something like, Trump tells Francis, I won't forget what you said. I won't forget what you said. And there's something about the Vatican. I mean, you've been there.
Yeah.
I've been there. When you walk into St. Peter's Basilica, I mean, you can have an ego the size of Donald Trump, But all of a sudden, you're humbled by that environment. You know, you're humbled by he apparently took a tour through the Basilica, through the actual Vatican. They met, I think, in the Vatican Library, which is where Reagan and John Paul II met when they met for the first time 35 years ago. And also, you know, just simply when I've talked to people who've met popes, who've met Pope Francis, and when you meet with that bishop in white, and in Francis's case, somebody with a very calm, friendly, winsome demeanor, I think it probably humbled Trump. And the pictures that I saw of him and Ivanka, you know, slightly veiled, Melania veiled. Melania even apparently, this is according to the National Catholic Register, gave a rosary to the Pope and asked him to bless it. Mm. So, I mean, I don't know if it's her rosary.
She came from a very Catholic country, did she not?
Well, that's true, she did. And the Pope even made a couple references to different Slovenian dishes that he knew of. And Slovenia was, I mean, that was part of the Balkans area that the Soviets and the communists were dominating from the 1940s to the 1980s. So, you know, they probably, in that respect, she surely has a respect for the Catholic Church. I mean, she noted that she was Slavic, and Pope John Paul II was the first and only Slavic pope.
Paul, thank you for your analysis on this. I can't urge the audience enough. Please, if you like Ronald Reagan, you are going to love Paul Kangor's book. Still waiting for an autographed copy, Paul, but no rush. A pope and a president. The story of John Paul and Ronald Reagan, this friendship that changed the world. It's a tremendous, tremendous read. Paul, thank you so much for being on.
Okay, Glenn, take care.
You got it.
Noticed how you happened to make a story about the Pope and the President about you, which was an interesting trick there. What an achievement!
Well, I thought it was the only way I could get an autographed copy. No. Saying it on the air, I could write him all day, and he's not going to do it.
Now he's got to.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury.
This is
the Glenn Beck Program.
So I know how the left, I know what a move of the left is going to be, I think. I think they're starting to lay the groundwork for the 24th Amendment, but I know it's the 25th Amendment, on how to... how to get rid of Donald Trump. And it's not going to be, I mean, they're going to try impeachment, but I think they're going to go for the 25th Amendment. They're going to start making the case that he's unfit to be president. And I found an article deep in the left circle of influence yesterday, and I read it and I thought, oh my gosh, look at what they're setting up. Look at what they're doing. They're now they now have neurolinguists, they have neurologists, they have psychiatrists, doctors that study the brain and the deterioration of the brain and Alzheimer's and all of this stuff. Now analyzing all of his speeches that are off the cuff. They are analyzing everything that he's saying now off the cuff. Nothing can be read. It has to be off the cuff. And they're comparing it to everything that he said prior to the year 2000. And I will tell you that the video that they have clipped together is quite remarkable. And you're left with thinking, and they bring this up. One guy brought up, this could be an act. This could be something that he's doing intentionally because he is trying to appeal to people who are just, you know, the Barstool Joe.
So, again, this is to try to prove that he's incapable of being president. The 25th Amendment would pull him out because he's incapacitated.
Because what they're saying is, what the doctors are saying is, look at his speech. Remember what he said, I have the best words. I use the best words. if you actually go back and look at what he has said in interviews off the cuff with Charlie Rose and everything else prior to 2000, he is very eloquent, very eloquent. It's quite amazing. And now he can't build a sentence. You know, now he gets so distracted and he'll start talking about something and then he'll be on to something else. And they're saying, this is what they're saying, 25th Amendment. I mean, I think he's suffering from mental deterioration and he's starting to fail.
These are the same people who say you should never question science because it's not political.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, is it?
That's exactly what I was shouting in the room by myself the whole time. I thought we weren't supposed to analyze people. Mm-hmm. But they got the best doctors to do this one. you read it. I want to share it with you because you have to prepare mentally for what's coming. And we better have a good argument and the right argument.
Can you imagine if we would have thrown this much stuff at the wall trying to get Obama out of office? Within three months of him being in office, we never said impeachment. We never said 25th Amendment.
No,
A lot of people did,
and it's the birth certificate. I mean, that birth certificate was this.
This is insane, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it is insane. From day one, they've been doing this.
Yeah. No, that's where they don't even understand. That's where they've gone wrong. Now, I think the Democrats...
And you tried to get them... Not to do this. But boy,
have they ignored
all that advice.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
But they've decided to do this because I think the press is unaware of their own actions, and they don't care. They just think they're right. I think the Democrats have done this intentionally. I mean, why would you hold a huge protest on the day after the inauguration? Wait a minute. Just wait. Let him do something. You know, they didn't even give it a chance to say he's all of our presidents. Oh, look, he's failing. And so the entire thing, I believe, is just built to bring their core closer to them. They're not reaching out to anybody. They just want their core closer to them and angry. And it just doesn't lead to any place good. Wait until they start on the 25th Amendment. Back in a minute.
The Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
The Glenn Beck Program.
106.1 FM Talk. TKK in Raleigh-Durham. Hello and welcome. We got a story just for you coming up in just a second. Ariana Grande. Can we just spend a minute on her? Now, this is the woman.
Yes.
This Jeffy. Figuratively. So Ariana Grande, she's the girl that was, her concert was bombed over in Manchester. And somebody came up to me yesterday and said, you tweeted something nice to her. And I'm like, yeah. She's the woman who licked the donuts.
Right.
Yeah, I got that. I'm supposed to be mean to her because of that. I'm not going to be her. She's the girl that went in, remember, was it during the election or even before the election?
Before the election.
Yeah, she licked the top of a donut and she said Americans are so stupid and just said some horrible things about America. There's a story out today about how her childhood she was a problem for her mom in Florida growing up. She described herself as a very weird little girl. She said, but she went through a dark and deranged period where her mother thought, literally, she would grow up to be a serial killer. She said, I always wanted to have a skeleton face paint or to be wearing a Freddy Krueger mask, and I would carry around a hockey stick. For my fifth birthday party, we had a Jaws theme, and all my friends left crying. I'm still that way, but it was a little more concerning back then. There was a stage at 3 or 4 where my mom thought I might be a serial killer when I grow up. She had this personality, and then, you know, you mix Nickelodeon into the mix, and it only had to get better. It only had to get better. But our thoughts and prayers are still with you, Ariana.
Certainly all the families and everybody affected by that.
Yes. I mean, everybody in Manchester, we're just, we're with you. You know, they have the army now roaming the streets.
Yeah.
Yeah, when they upped the terror threat, and they said that they thought it might mean that another attack is imminent. And so they've, the army, and it's a mess. It's a mess. But luckily and hopefully this continues, so far nothing else.
God help us. God help us. I mean, can you imagine what it'll do to America if we have armed troops on the streets of America? I can't even imagine. And you start targeting our children, we do that. Mm-hmm. We do that. All right. Raleigh, Durham. Pat will not let this go until we give him a chance to vent on the lacrosse team.
Yeah, the Duke lacrosse team. I just saw an ESPN 30 for 30 on that, because it's in fact, I'm not sure why they did it, because it's been over 10 years, right?
Has it been 10 years?
Yeah, I think it's a little more than that. Was it 2006? 2000? Maybe it was 2007. It might be 10 years.
No, it didn't happen under George Bush, did it?
Yeah.
Did it?
Huh. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
2006.
Yeah. So that, everybody assumed, I guess, that because these guys are white, they go to a school that's kind of the Ivy League of the South. Because it costs a lot of money and you're rich. I guess they just thought they were privileged white kids who think they can do anything. And, nobody says that the party, except for Jeffy, was necessarily a really good idea. But they they didn't do anything to the stripper. And they had Black Lives Matter type demonstrations outside the campus almost every day.
Can you imagine
before these facts even came out?
Imagine what these kids went through.
Oh my gosh, they went through hell. They went through hell. First of all, they canceled the next game, and so they said, we're just going to cancel this game and the next one, and then we'll let this thing die down a little bit, and then you can play lacrosse again. Well, they wound up canceling the entire season. So all of those guys who went to Duke on lacrosse scholarships, they were ranked number one in the country at the time, lost their season. It's completely out the window. Then three of them lost their freedom because they were arrested and charged with murder or rape, I mean. And they were facing up to 30 years in prison. 18, 19, 20-year-old guys who wouldn't get out till they're 50 years old. And everybody just assumed they were guilty of sin. Okay. And that they were spoiled, rotten brats who think that they could do anything to a black woman. And it was all racist and all. And Al Sharpton came down. He was leading the mob.
Jesse Jackson
came down. He was leading mobs. And they were demanding that every single one of the 40. There's 45 guys on that Duke lacrosse team. I had no idea. I mean, how many play at once? Like 8? you've got a lot of substitutions there to go through. But they wanted them all expelled. Whole team expelled and then arrested. Well, the prosecutor in the case, this Mike Nifong, was in an election at the time. And so he used this, tried to use it to his advantage. And he went after these guys.
Has that ever backfired on him?
Yeah, he was disbarred. Lost his
job. Was
he
really?
Disbarred.
Good for that.
Deserved all of it.
Oh, every
little. And then some. But
why? What did he? I'm sorry, but it's been over 10 years. I don't really even remember what happened.
I had forgotten a lot of
these. I remember his name. I remember thinking at the time, oh my gosh, this guy has either got him dead to rights and knows stuff that he's not releasing, or this is a lynch mob.
And it was a lynch mob. And he even, they couldn't find any DNA from these guys on her. But they did find, supposedly, he said they found on a false fingernail that was in the garbage can
of the bathroom.
In the bathroom, they found one of the lacrosse players' DNA on it. Well, the defense team eventually said, "Okay, well, we need all those results," and they fought really hard to get them because it took a long time.
How did they not get those results? Those should have.
They were trying to keep them from him.
How?
He stonewalled every.
That's crazy.
Effort. Yeah, the whole thing was crazy. They finally got 2,500 pages of DNA samples. And so one of the lawyers just sat down and for four straight days didn't leave the office and went through all of that DNA. And he happened to notice that at the top of certain pages was the notation in handwriting, does not match 171516, and then so on, and the two other numbers. He's like, what is that? Does not match. Well, it was the three accused Duke players. Did not match any of them. Didn't. And Nifong was saying that we found, I think it was Eric Davis's DNA in the garbage can. It wasn't his DNA. It wasn't anybody on the lacrosse team's DNA. But what they did find was the DNA of up to 11 other men in, on, and around her. 11 other men. None of whom were the Duke lacrosse team.
Okay, so wait. So she had sex?
Apparently with
11 men at the party?
They say 7 to 11. No, it was not at the party. It was somewhere else. Maybe before or after the party. Somewhere between her going to the hospital and, you know, having the samples taken. Either before the party or after the party. On the way to the hospital. So my guess is it was probably before the party. But it took a year to resolve this for these guys. In the meantime, their season was wiped out. Their lives were turned upside down. Yeah. They couldn't get jobs for years.
Can you imagine you're part of the... You just have Duke lacrosse team on your resume?
Oh my gosh.
You wouldn't put it there.
No, you wouldn't.
Because you would be immediately
but
asked.
Their names were everywhere, so everybody knew.
Yeah, a friend of someone we used to work with was on the Duke lacrosse team at that time. Not one of the main accusers, but or accused. And really smart, like was, off to an obvious career of success. Even after they were cleared for years, had to answer questions about it, lost job opportunities because of it. Because this was so negatively associated. Duke lacrosse team meant rape.
So what do you think? What do you think of this?
Even though they were all exonerated,
completely
innocent of doing any of the things that were accused.
What do you think of this? I think we are still entering the days to where history will look back at this time in 100 years or so as the Salem witch trials. Think of the people
Think
of the people who have lost their job for not doing anything, just disagreeing, not being willing to stand in a circle pointing, saying, witch. I mean, I think we are in the new era of the potential of being remembered as the Salem witch trial days.
I think so too. I think so too, and it's been boiling up for a long time. This was 10 years ago. It's gotten worse since then.
What was it? Did they cover what were the ramifications for her for the false accusation? Any?
Nothing. She wasn't arrested for
nothing?
It.
Nothing?
No, nothing. Well, until 2013 when she murdered her boyfriend. Then she had some ramifications.
Oh, okay.
Now she's in prison because she killed her boyfriend.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. Well, she was unstable. That's for sure. They did find out that she was unstable. She'd had, mental issues for some time.
And look at that. Look at gone in Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton went in, took this unstable individual, wound her
right,
up.
Right.
I mean,
never, and those two guys never apologized for their role in amping up hysteria against these guys.
It's white privilege. They're guilty still.
Right.
And what was Sharpton's?
Still guilty.
Sharpton's answer was, "We know something happened in that house." Well, something
happens
in every house.
She danced. That's what happened.
Dinner is made. People go to the bathroom. People make their beds. Things happen in houses. Yes, that's not that has nothing to do with this story.
And the strippers
is that not again a Salem witch trial
you bet it
sort
is.
Of answer.
Yeah. You bet it is.
We know something happened.
And the stripper, at the end of the 30 for 30, is that what it's called?
Yeah. 30 for 30.
One of the allies of the, and I think it was her brother. I think they said this was her brother. He says, well, okay, well, maybe they didn't rape her, but something happened. So he's still maintaining that very line of thinking. Something happened. What do you mean something happened? Yeah, she came and danced and
well,
left.
Because people believe where there's smoke, there's fire.
Yeah. And there was no fire
where there's
here.
Smoke. For instance, this is a good one. Donald Trump and Russia. There's tons of smoke. I honestly, yeah. when it comes to
Donald
Trump,
I don't think there's any fire. Yeah.
I don't think there's any fire. I think there's fire around him, but I don't think with Donald Trump there's
well,
any fire.
Manafort, there.
There
was fire.
Fire.
Right?
With Flynn, there's
Flynn,
fire.
Yeah, but not Trump.
Right. I don't think he's involved. I don't think he knows. I don't think he's that guy. Mm-hmm. You know, the telling of secrets to Russia or whatever. I think he's just.
I mean, they say it all the time. We haven't found, there's no collusion, but.
Right.
But.
We know something happened. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. We also know something happened with the IRS, but
yes.
you never found that. We also know something happened with all the classified documents with Hillary Clinton, but you didn't follow that.
Something happened with Benghazi where four Americans died, but
you
we
didn't
never
follow
got to
that.
The bottom of that.
We know that Susan Rice lied, but you're still using her as a character witness in this one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the witch trials again.
Attorney General, Mr. We're going to run guns.
Right, right. I mean, that's why I think this is why 70% of Americans want a special counsel, wanted a special counsel. Whether Mueller is the right guy or not, I don't know. But I, for one, I do want to believe in someone. I do want to believe that justice does exist. Yeah. But when you hear stuff mm-hmm. like this, it's pretty hard to believe it.
Yeah, it is.
You kind of understand the African-American experience of the past where you just couldn't get it. You're not going to get a fair trial. I mean, how long does that have to go on before you never believe you're going to get a fair trial? And that's why, I mean, that's, you know, even today, OJ's not going to get a fair trial. You know, and he did. And he walked away scot-free, and I think everybody understands he killed her.
And, you know, on that point, one of the defense attorneys said, you know, people think this is a unique case. It's not. It happens every day in the American justice system. That's kind of chilling to think of. Happens every day? Wow.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury. Glenn Beck Program.
Hey, we have to say happy birthday to one of our favorite listeners and one of our oldest listeners, if not our oldest, 102 years old and still as sharp as he was 102 years ago. Well, probably as sharp as he was maybe 80 years ago. Saying that he was as sharp as he was when he was born isn't very sharp. My apologies. Chippy, happy birthday.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Look at the headlines of today. FCC will not take action over Stephen Colbert's Trump remarks. Trump slips in his infrastructure, his $1 trillion stimulus package, just slips it into the budget. The Pope urged Trump to work for peace and climate change, or work against climate change, I guess, and for peace. Alan Dershowitz says terrorism persists because it works. And the BBC is reporting today that the Manchester attack, the bomber, was not acting alone. How do you make sense? How do we take the chaos we're living in and function in it? because you it's impossible to keep up with the news and the changes in the world. It's impossible. So what do? And where do you find courage? How do you manage when everything seems to be chaotic around you, or things are not going according to plan? We have an absolutely amazing 37-year-old guy who has literally lived, I think, 5, in my case, 100 of my lifetimes. You won't believe what this man has accomplished and the adversity that he has gone through. And the perspective he has now at 37 will take most of us at least 5 lifetimes to gather. How do we navigate in a world gone mad, in a world ruled by fear? Isaac Lidsky joins us right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
I just want you to listen to this guy's resume, because just one of these things people would chew on for the rest of their life and say, yeah, I did that. Listen to this. He was on the TV show Saved by the Bell, the new class. He played Weasel. He went to Harvard and graduated with a degree in mathematics and computer science at 19. He then graduated magna cum laude from Harvard Law School. He then went to clerk for the Supreme Court for Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. He then argued more than a dozen federal cases and never lost a single one. He then decided, you know what, I'm going to start my own tech company. He started his own tech company and sold it for $230 million. He is the CEO of a construction company now, which has grown in value by 10 times since he took over. Oh, and I forgot to mention, he realized very young that he was losing his sight. He went completely blind at 25, but it didn't slow him down. After he went completely blind, he decided he was going to start a charity called Hope for Vision that funds development and treatments and cures for blindness, which he believes he will be able to see again, and you'll be able to cure some forms of blindness within 5 to 10 years. Now, I don't know about you, but I had a hard time getting out of bed today. Let's say hello to the mass overachiever that makes us all look bad, Isaac Lidsky. How are you, Isaac?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Good. Your book is called Eyes Wide Open. I want to add one more thing to your resume. He lives in Florida with his wife, Dorothy, and their 3 triplet daughters. So he's also raising triplets while he's doing all the other thing. So do you ever sleep, Isaac?
Yeah, I do. I do. I sleep, and I sleep well, Glenn, because I'm very blessed. As you mentioned, I've gotten to do a lot of really interesting and rewarding things in my life. And, you know, in many ways, the experience I had losing my sight was one of the best things that ever happened to me.
So I'd like to start there. I have macular dystrophy, and if you probably know, you can lose your eyesight quickly, or you can have macular dystrophy for the rest of your life, and it will never change anything. But I will tell you, when I was diagnosed, it freaked me out, and it's made me a better man. But I didn't lose my eyes. Can you take us to the tree limb when you're 7 years old?
Sure. So, yeah, I was diagnosed when I was 13 years old.
13, okay.
Yeah, and at the time, you know, I was living this Hollywood fairy tale, and, you know, like most 13-year-old boys, I thought I was, you know, perfect and invincible and, you know, on top of the world.
at the time I, you know, received the diagnosis, you know, basically told you have this disease, you're going to go blind. There's no treatments. There's no cures. You know, we don't know much about the disease. Good luck was essentially the message.
And when you were diagnosed with it, did you know that it was going to be a rapid decline?
You know, the doctor, the expert said that he couldn't tell me how long it would take. You know, we hoped, you know, best case scenario, 30s, 40s or 50s, you know, before I'm blind. But he really had no idea. You know, at the time they knew very little about the disease. I wound up losing my sight, as you said, in over about a dozen years. You know, at the time of the diagnosis, I was not only was I terrified, but I knew that blindness was going to destroy my life. I knew it was going to be, you know, an end to my achievement, and it meant I would live this sort of small and unremarkable life, you know, very sad and likely alone. And of course, those, you know, those were lies. That was sort of the fictions born of my fears, awfulizing, as psychologists call it. But at the time, it felt real. It felt like my reality, like my destiny.
So you're sitting on the tree branch, and you're actually 17, not 7, 17 at this time, and you realize... Mm-hmm. It's coming quickly?
Yeah, so, you know.
Oh, you got to be kidding me. The overachiever can't get good cell service? I think we lost him.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, we did.
So young, too.
I know, we barely know him.
We barely knew him.
We just lost the call.
Oh, we just lost the call.
Yes, he's not
okay,
gone.
Good. Okay, good.
Him as a person.
Whew, good. Then could you get him back on the phone? Because it would have been a really depressing rest of the show.
No, I'm here.
Oh, you're there. Okay, good. Okay, we lost you. Go ahead. Sorry. All right.
So anyway, you know, by the time I was in my early to mid-20s, I was completely blind. But, you know, in a remarkable way, in a beautiful way, sort of the disease itself was really sort of the cure in many ways. As I lost my sight, the way that I sort of progressively lost my sight, the bizarre kind of visual effects I experienced gave me just tremendous insight into the awesome power of the mind, the way our minds work, and our ultimate, you know, power to really, you know, create the reality we want for ourselves.
Because you say you don't need your eyes to see the world.
No, you don't. Well, you don't need your eyes for vision. You don't need your eyes for vision. So, you know, people, I'm a big stickler on the distinction between sight and vision. Mm. And to my mind, vision's got nothing to do with the eyes. And losing my sight is what gave me this very rewarding vision that really has brought me just immeasurable joy and fulfillment and success in my life, and it's been such a blessing for me. The vision has nothing to do with blindness or disability, or I mean, in my case, you know, it came about because of that. But it really is for everybody, and that's why I you know, wrote the book.
Can you be the person, the complete person that you were born to be, without some form of adversity?
As a general proposition?
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, to my mind, sort of in my experience, what I've seen is really in every moment, we are choosing who we want to be and how we want to live our lives. You know, whether we like it or not, whether we want to admit it or not, we're making that choice in every single moment.
So how did you learn that? How did you learn that if not through adversity?
I learned it by this sort of bizarre experience I had, going blind, losing my sight. I literally saw that far from some kind of passive experience, some sort of perception of the world out there, sight is this masterful illusion, a very compelling illusion. And as that illusion sort of shattered for me, it kind of helped me to realize all this stuff. But
Wait, go back. That's such a profound statement, and I want to make sure I understand it. What do you mean that sight is a masterful illusion?
So, you know, the experience of sight, you open your eyes and there's the world, right? It feels very passive. It feels like, you know, sight is true. We even say, you know, seeing is believing. The fact of the matter is altogether different. The reality is sight is this sort of unique, personal, virtual world that your brain sort of cooks up for you. And it implicates your conceptual knowledge, your memories, your opinions, your emotions. You know, really only about 10% of the experience of sight is data from the eyes in any given moment. And yet it feels so real and so objective. So we literally create our own realities and we believe it. And I mean, studies show this, and there's all sorts of, you know, optical illusions that show this, and, you know, just life experience, but yet, you know, it feels so real. And I saw that firsthand. I literally kind of got a peek at the wizard behind the curtain, so to speak. And then I realized that the same is true of so much of life, the way we experience our fears, the way we experience our self-limiting assumptions about ourselves, that what we tell ourselves about, you know, strength and weakness and quote unquote success and all that. And, you know, so much of our worlds, our realities is, you know, machinations of our own minds. And if we want to be aware of it and intentional and, you know, and live with discipline, we can take control of that reality and really create the lives we want for ourselves in every moment. So, and that's been my life, and it's, I feel, you know, profoundly blessed.
And is this what you mean when you say we have to take responsibility for our? Let me see. I want to quote it exactly. We have to take ownership of our mental images.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So you know, we there's so many examples, but you know, take the self-limiting assumptions we make about ourselves, the things we tell ourselves we cannot do, the purported shortcomings we perceive in ourselves, all these awful cues, we make up from those around us. We read into things, and you know, a lot of times it's not always obvious to us that, you know, we're the author of these fictions, but we ultimately we are. And when we can see that, and when we can see our role, we can make better choices for ourselves.
So we're talking to Isaac Lidsky. He is the author of a book called Eyes Wide Open: Overcoming Obstacles and Recognizing Opportunities in a World That Can't See Clearly. And Isaac, I wanted to have you on because it's my job and my mission in my own life, but it's my job to try to make sense of a world gone mad and not follow it over the cliff. And we are dealing with so many lies now and so much chaos in the world. We can't keep up with it. I think we have this cultural fear of losing what we know, and part of that is because we are losing, you know, some of our past. But in some ways, some of it is really good with high tech. Yeah, we are in this tension now of losing jobs that just are never coming back, but the future is very, very bright. What advice do you have on navigating through some of these fears, both real and maybe overhyped or perceived?
Yeah, you know, that's a fantastic question. I mean, it's true. I mean, it's a world of madness these days. You know, when truth is a relative term, and accountability seems absent. It's hard to stay grounded, but I firmly believe it's got to start, you know, from within. It's got to start with yourself. And you know, we all face challenges and great fears and struggles in our lives. But you know, what I always come back to is always you will find people who have done far more with far less and been a lot happier doing it. By the way, so it can't be the circumstances we face that determine the quality of lives that we live. I mean, how those circumstances manifest themselves in our lives is entirely within our control. And it's not easy to do, but it's certainly worth it. So I would encourage folks to live with, you know, awareness, intentionality, and purpose. Embrace your role as the master of your reality, as the person who gets to decide the life you live in every moment. And you can abdicate that responsibility if it's overwhelming, but I certainly think that's a bad choice.
Help me out on I'm an alcoholic, recovering alcoholic, and it's and understanding the 12 steps has just changed my life. Understanding the message of surrender, but that doesn't mean you accept. You accept the part that you played, you surrender to the things that you're powerless to change, but then you pick up your gauntlet, you pick yourself back up, and you charge ahead. We don't have a real understanding of what you say. Let me see, a thin, elusive line between acceptance and surrender, between confidence and vulnerability. What do you mean?
Yeah, you know, among the many, unfortunate things we can tell ourselves, we have this understanding that vulnerability is weakness. Sometimes we get cues from society, and you know, we can tend to tell ourselves that. And you know, I certainly struggled with that as I was losing my sight. I thought that, you know, being vulnerable, needing help, All those things were weakness. I thought, you know, disability was, you know, was embarrassment. And, you know, these are just awful narratives that, are, you know, they're self-fulfilling to the extent that we tell ourselves those things and believe them. You know, we make them true. But they're, you know, there's nothing that, there's no inherent truth in those lies. In fact, you know, in fact, they're toxic. They're awful. So I learned, and it took me a while. It was a journey that, you know, that I describe at length, but, you know, I learned to embrace, you know, who I am, challenges and all, blindness and all, but, to see strengths, where I might've first seen weakness or where others saw weakness. And to find my own, you know, my own confidence and embrace who I am in my life. And, you know, think about the circumstances people have confronted. You know, you have prisoners of war who have, you know, undergone years of torture. You know, you have, you know, Viktor Frankl in a Nazi concentration camp. You know, he wrote a book, Man's Search for Meaning. He talks about how he insisted he was going to find purpose and even happiness in a concentration camp. And, you know, all these examples of remarkable people who transcend. Despite their circumstances, they you know, probably wouldn't put it exactly the same way that I do, but I am sure that if you ask those folks, every one of them, you know, would view him or herself as in control of their reality, as the master of their own fate, as the person who gets to decide how the circumstances they confront are going to manifest themselves in their lives. And that's the power we all have, whether we realize it or not.
Author of the book Eyes Wide Open. We will come back in just a second.
This is
the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
We're thrilled to have Isaac Lidsky. If you are looking for a story of courage, an amazing story. I mean, the guy freaking graduated from Harvard at 19. And then, oh, I'm going to be an attorney. Oh, I guess I'll clerk for the Supreme Court for two different justices. You know what? I'm going to try some cases. Oh, and I'm going to never lose a single case. Hey, I know. Why don't I start a business and sell it for $250 million? Hey, let's start another business and have it grow tenfold. Oh, and I'm also going to raise triplets at the same time. Oh, and I'm blind. Okay, overachiever. Sit down. You're making the rest of us look bad.
He's not the only one who does amazing things, though. I mean, I almost went to the gym yesterday.
Right.
You almost did?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, hey, I didn't get there. I didn't...
Keep working the program.
Right. I drove by it.
Right.
And I didn't slow down per se, but I could have potentially.
Can I tell you something? You know what I did yesterday? I took the clothing, you know, on the coat hangers off my exercise bike yesterday.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
Yeah. You lifted them? I mean, that's
Well, no, I had somebody else do. I said, hey, can you remove those clothes? Hmm. It looks, my wife is coming. It looks like I never used the exercise bike.
That's pretty much the Isaac Lidsky story. You just,
thank you. Yeah. And did I tell you I could be going blind?
Yeah, I mean, you haven't. To be clear, you haven't gone blind yet.
No, I haven't. No,
but
I haven't.
But you could, in theory, in the future.
At any time, I have the condition that could, anytime the lights could go out.
Right, so.
Probably won't happen.
Your story is actually a little better than his, but I guess we go back to it in a minute anyway.
Yeah, we're going to go back to him and we'll hear his little story about, oh, look at me.
The Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Eyes Wide Open is a great book of I'm just going to call him a serial killer just to knock him down a notch or two, because he is the most amazing guy at 37 years old, has lived five very successful lifetimes. His name is Isaac Lidsky. He has clerked for the Supreme Court. He graduated from Harvard at 19. He's argued cases and never lost one. Then he started his own tech business and sold it for a quarter of $1 billion. And he's blind and a father of triplets. So he makes me feel like I haven't done anything with my life.
Yeah, well, you know what? I've never lost a court case either. So
that's right.
I can say the same thing.
Amen,
same
brother.
Thank you, right?
So Isaac, put that in your pipe and smoke it.
And also, Glenn, I unlike you, did not ask somebody to remove my my dry cleaning from the treadmill yesterday.
Wow. Right? Did you do that yourself?
Right.
I don't put it there in the first place because I use my treadmill.
Wow.
Shut up. If you, I have not seen a picture of you, but if you are all buff and handsome, I hate your guts.
I'm told I look okay.
Okay. By blind people? By blind people?
Well, blind people see with their hands, so that's a whole other conversation.
Okay. So,
I do want to say, all kidding aside, you're very generous to stress, you know, my various accomplishments and the blessings that I have. But I do really want to stress that, you know, for me, living and leading, you know, eyes wide open, you know, with the joy, the fulfillment I find in my life really is, it's not about the achievements or the outcomes, really. It's, you know, as, you know, Teddy Roosevelt's critic and strongman, you know, remarks, which I love, you know, success is in the actual striving, and it's a Zen mind trick, but it's just a function of the human condition that when you focus on the actual striving and finding the things that really matter and mean something to you, the success tends to come about as a byproduct.
And that is so important, and I only hear that from successful people. So, but it is true. I've met very successful people that don't have material success at all, and success really is wanting what you have or wanting what you need. Go ahead.
I can tell you, as a father of four, because, you know, we have the triplets, but we also have a baby. So we have 6.5-year-old triplets and an 18-month-old.
I hope you and your wife have 10 more children.
I would love to have 10 more children.
At the same time.
I meant it once.
Isaac, you say, but, go ahead.
Go ahead, finish yourself.
What I want for my children is a life lived, eyes wide open, with a lot of joy and fulfillment. And I can tell you that none of the things on my resume necessarily imply or even correlate with those things.
Right.
In fact, too often there's a reverse, you know, an inverse correlation.
I think people in our society, they look at fame and fortune as the problem to their solutions. Solutions to their problems. Your problems only get bigger with fame and fortune and more complex sometimes. I mean, you have to solve the basic fundamentals of who you are. And once you solve that or begin to solve that, then you can wrestle with the fame and the obscurity, because they're both imposters and you'll treat them that way.
I could not agree with you more. And I could not have put it better. I mean, you know, it starts with, you know, the big questions, and it's easy to roll your eyes, but it starts with, like, who do you want to be? Who do you want to be as a boss, as a colleague, as an employee, as a spouse, as a parent? I mean, who do you want to be alone at night with yourself? How do you want to spend your time?
I think we ask the wrong question of our children. What do you want to be? We should be asking them, who do you want to be?
I completely agree with you. I think that's demonstrably true. And by the way, what you want to be, not only is it less important, but it can change a million times now more than ever.
Yeah.
It's funny because, you know, if it were about, you know, successes and the resume and, you know, the sitcom and all that, I gotta be honest with you, I would have zero interest in writing the book or sharing my story or even, you know, talking to you today. I am convinced beyond a doubt. I'm convinced at my core that I was blessed with a glimpse, into, our power and our responsibility to be accountable for, you know, creating the lives we want for ourselves. And that is a gift that I feel almost a calling to share with others. And so, you know, it's not about the resume at all.
Isaac, you say that you fully expect to get to have your sight restored within the next 5 to 10 years. Are we that close to cures for certain types of blindness?
Absolutely no doubt about it. In particular, there's a group at the University of Iowa, Dr. Ed Stone and the Steve Wynn Vision Center. I forget exactly the name of it, but Steve Wynn. I had the extreme privilege of visiting with them, I guess, in February. And the stuff they are doing is the stuff of science fiction. If you had described the work that they're doing to me before I went out there, I would say, gosh, yeah, you know, 50 years, 100 years, they'll be able to do that. And, like, they've done it already in animals, and they're in human clinical trials. And it's just, now,
is it implants? What is it exactly?
Or is it a cochlear, a fake vision, or is it restored natural vision?
It's a longer answer. I'll try to simplify. Essentially, what they are doing is they take some of your skin cells, they reverse engineer some healthy photoreceptor cells, retinal cells from those. They then implant them using this
3D
printing nanotechnology thing, and they essentially recreate in your retina the process that happens, in the womb and in early infancy of the
development. So it is restoration. It's restoration of your natural vision. It's not some.
Yes, it is literally the regeneration.
Not some computer animated
retina.
Thing.
Wow,
it's mind-boggling.
Oh, that's phenomenal.
So why didn't Geordi on Star Trek get that done?
Right?
This is the one problem I have with that show.
Right?
I mean,
right?
Otherwise, it is so realistic.
let me take you one more place before we have to go.
Sure.
You have a chapter on how to listen better. And I think this is... I think this is the problem in our country. We're not listening to each other, and in many cases, we're choosing not to listen to each other. How do we reverse that?
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening.
Oh, good, let's add that. He's funny, too.
you're absolutely right. I mean, listening, God bless, it's just... it's such an important and profound skill and gift and human attribute, and we're so bad at it. We are just awful at it. And this I will say, as I went blind and learned to rely on my ears a lot more, I realized that even I as a sighted guy, we pay so little attention to our ears and what we're hearing, but then sort of at a deeper level, we pay little attention to the words people are choosing when they communicate with us, and we're focusing on what we're seeing and gestures and facial expressions, and we're projecting what we want to hear, or what we fear we're going to hear versus what the person's actually trying to say, and it's just madness. And particularly, you mentioned the sort of political climate we're in, the challenges we have in the world with terrorism and hate and polarization, and God, it would be such a good first step for us to focus on actually listening to each other.
What's the one thing that you can't wait to see?
My children's faces. I've never seen my kids' faces.
Pretty good answer.
It's really the only thing. I mean,
yeah.
What's
you don't care about seeing your wife again?
She's let herself go. I don't know if you know that.
Good Lord. I love you, honey. I love you. I didn't say that. That wasn't me. I can't control what he says.
it's been really great to talk to you, Isaac, and getting to know you a little bit better. I hope we talk again.
I would love that. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
You bet. The name of the book is Eyes Wide Open. Eyes Wide Open, Overcoming Obstacles and Recognizing the Opportunities in a World That Can't See Clearly. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
God bless. And my best to your wife. She, I'm sure, is stunning and looks better than she's ever looked.
Glenn Beck Program.
888-727-BACK.
Mercury. Glenn Beck Program.
888-727-BECK.
So glad that you're here.
Are you?
Thank you. We appreciate it.
We're happy to be here as well. Thank you. I'm glad you're here too, because I like to hear about truth on this show.
Mm-hmm.
And Glenn's the guy who always brings it to us, right? That's what he does.
That's his role. That's what he does.
Certainly, he wouldn't go on the air and say that he had removed clothing from his exercise equipment when, in fact, he had not.
I thought about having somebody remove the clothing from my exercise bike.
Because my wife was coming,
and she did come yesterday, and I thought about it, but I didn't get around to it. I was busy searching for the truth, I was lazy.
Those who follow at Glenn Beck or at World of Stew may have seen a photo that was just recently tweeted from both accounts.
Do you have access, Michelle?
And Jeffy MRA went ahead and retweeted that as well.
That's who you got that from too, wasn't it? It was Michelle.
It seems like Michelle and perhaps also Matthew.
Really? My two helpers.
What they both believe is something called the truth lives here. Hear something called out that's obviously false and they can prove it to be false,
okay,
they acquire evidence
not
of that
necessary.
Fact.
There's my, there's my dressing room, yeah. And okay, so there's a couple pairs of pants and some ties on it. I can still ride the bike, honey. I'm
not your honey.
I'm not talking to you.
Okay.
I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to my wife, who was up before me this morning and then gently woke me up. Honey, it's time to go. Well, where are you all? I'm going to the gym. Shut up! Shut up!
My wife is now at the point where she goes to the gym and then comes back before I wake up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's infuriating.
So my wife goes to the gym. Here's what she did on Saturday. On Friday night, I'm like, oh, I'm so glad we can sleep in tomorrow. No, I'm going to the gym. What? I'm going to the gym. It's Saturday. Yeah, I'm going to the gym. And then she came back. Can you watch the kids for an hour? There's a great rowing class that I just really want to take. A class? You sit on a thing and you pull. What? How hard is that? There's your class. Wait, you going to a class? She came back. I'm so excited to go rowing. They're hypnotizing you.
Yeah.
That's what's happening. They're hypnotizing you or they're putting something in the drinking water. Nobody wants to row. Nobody. They had slaves do that because they couldn't get any volunteers in olden times.
Glenn Beck.
Mercury.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Glenn Beck program. U2 was on Jimmy Kimmel, and they addressed the Manchester terrorist attack. We want to visit that. Also, Brian May, who is the lead guitarist of Queen, we don't learn our lesson. He also had a few things to say. But I also want to go back while we're here with Bono. I will tell you, I think I'm impressed with Bono more than any other celebrity out there. Wouldn't you say?
I love the guy now.
Yeah, I mean,
he's great.
He's truly honest and saying some really risky and powerful things.
For a rock star?
Oh, my God.
That the left adores?
It's
really risky.
Amazing what he has been saying lately. We want to play something that came out a couple of days ago. We'll go into that, and we begin with Manchester right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck program.
So, if you haven't seen television yet, their military has been unleashed in the UK. It's everywhere, and they are. I mean, it's beginning to look a little like the 1930s and 40s in England with all of the troops on the streets. Here's what the British Prime Minister just said.
But the work undertaken throughout the day has revealed that it is a possibility we cannot ignore, that there is a wider group of individuals linked to this attack. This morning I said that the Joint Terrorism Analysis Centre, the independent organisation responsible for setting the threat level on the basis of the intelligence available, was keeping the threat level under constant review. It has now concluded, on the basis of today's investigations, that the threat level should be increased, for the time being, from severe to critical. This means that their assessment is not only that an attack remains highly likely, but that a further attack may be imminent.
Wow.
The change in the threat level means that there will be additional resources and support made available to the police as they work to keep us all safe.
And this is how it happens. And this is how it happens. We have got to keep our heads about us and not give in to fear and not relinquish liberty for a feeling of security. Our prayers are with everyone in England, our greatest and most trusted ally. You know, I was reading, I was listening to some Winston Churchill yesterday. And have you ever read Winston Churchill? You read Winston Churchill. He's one of the greatest writers of all time. Won, I think, a Pulitzer Prize for his writing. Tremendous writer and prolific. And he wrote every speech himself. But boy, what a horrible speech giver he was. He was just like, you don't even understand him. And towards the end, he's like, and I've got some mush in my mouth. You're like, what is he even saying? But hopefully, Prime Minister May will be up to the task of taking that country through what is, unfortunately, possibly ahead for them. Now let me switch gears and play some audio here from Brian May. Now, he's the lead guitarist for Queen. And as you listen to this, you wonder, will we ever learn our lesson?
And if you, to me, it's almost impossible to imagine the kind of hatred that has to exist in someone if they would bomb children. And I'm afraid I regard everything as an opportunity. You know, out of tragedy comes knowledge and realization. And to me, 9/11 and all these terrible disasters are an opportunity to reevaluate ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
I think we failed to do that in 9/11, and we went on bombing people. Tony Blair, David Cameron still have this attitude that you can solve a violent situation by violence. I don't believe that. I believe we have to sweep all that away and start again. If we really think...
Okay, stop for a second.
Remember when we loved Hitler into submission? We put our arms around him and gave him a big hug.
May I suggest, I'm trying to be reasonable and trying to find truth here. May I suggest he's saying two things, and he's right about one of them. That 9/11, we missed the opportunity to self-examine, and we still have not done it. What I mean by that is, I believe that many in this audience, now hear me carefully, listen carefully.
This sounds really dangerous.
Yes, listen carefully. If you're listening carefully, you will understand what I mean. If you're a sloppy listener, you're going to just get pissed.
Everyone stop what you're doing. Turn off the radio.
Okay.
Pay attention.
So here's the opportunity we missed. And I think many of us feel this way, that the decisions that we have made really since World War I, since Teddy Roosevelt, of getting involved in everybody's business, going down in South America and putting dictators in, has only made communism rise up and the hatred for America because of what the CIA did. Going in and putting in the Shah of Iran in the 1950s and protecting him helped give rise to extremism in Iran. By living such a duplicitous life where we say, we're America, we don't torture. Oh, but we'll pick you up with a ghost plane and drop you off at Mubarak, who's our buddy, who will torture you till the end of time. We've caused a lot of animosity, and more importantly, we don't stand for anything anymore. We think we do, because we didn't pay attention to the duplicity.
We could do a better job, I think, of governing ourselves. But that's not what caused
Wait. So what I'm saying is half. What I'm saying is we did not self-examine. If we really would have self-examined, there would be more people who are saying, let's let's bring some of our troops home. Let's stop some of this nonsense because we're only making it, we're only helping them get stronger. Unless you have a plan to go in and wipe it off the map like we did in World War II and then get the hell out of there.
Which we do not.
Which we never do. No. Instead, we prop up another dictator. Look what we're doing now with the Syrian Kurds. They are not the Kurds of Iraq. The Kurds in Iraq are great. These guys are Marxist-Leninists who don't even speak the same language. And we're arming them. They are really bad guys. So what happens in 10 years, 5 years, a year? Are we going to be dealing with those guys too? The answer is yes.
Yeah, I mean, we know what we did not work out incredibly well or perfectly, certainly.
I'm now, talking over the last 100 years.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think it's easy also, though, to look at and say, well, if we had done the opposite, it would have worked. That's not necessarily true either.
You're exactly right.
We may have seen massive other gigantic problems if we had acted in different ways.
But we do know that for 100 years, I mean, look, after 100 years of this country, France, there's not a nice person coast to coast in France. Google, search all of France.
Really?
Maybe you find one person. Mm-hmm. You certainly don't find two nice people. Okay? They gave us the Statue of Liberty because the world admired us because we were still living George Washington's maxim of stay out of everybody's business. Let's take care of ourselves, pay attention to what we're doing, be friends to everybody. Enemies to nobody, unless you cross us and you do harm on us, then we're going to wipe you out. And it was Teddy Roosevelt who changed that and said, you know what? We're an important country now, and we have to protect the whole world and bring this democracy to everybody.
And there's no question that we would do really well to attack only if attacked.
Yes.
And we haven't done that for a really long time. But I think even entertaining these things kind of gives credence to this nonsense that people like Brian May say, where
if we just give them a hug and found out why they're so angry.
May I ask you, what is the difference between this is one of the problems that we have in our society now? You can't talk about complex issues because people conflate one thing with another. Right now, we'll say, wait a minute, we had a problem with Hillary Clinton and just exposing our national secrets. Donald Trump is doing the same thing. Why are you talking about Donald Trump? You're calling her Hillary Clinton? You're calling him Hillary Clinton? What about... No, I'm not tearing him down on everything. We've supported him on many things he's done. But this particular issue is a problem. We have to be able to take arguments apart and say, this part we should examine. Mm-hmm. This part is nonsense.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that in this clip.
We can solve this kind of violent behavior by being violent ourselves.
Yeah, we can't do that.
And
Nazis.
Being racist and, you know, reacting in that
being
way.
Being racist.
Then we are in for the most terrible tragedy for the world, you know, because this is how it escalates.
I hate that.
To me, you have to break the cycle of violence and you have to treat horrific events with compassion, strangely enough. And I don't mean compassion for the person who did the bombing. I mean, you have to look at the world and say, what part do we play in the world? Of course, we have to tighten up security. I mean, we'll be playing that arena in December.
Really?
Oh, yeah, I need to be
safe. We've played it before. We'll be playing in December. No, we won't cancel. Because life has to go on. That's what they want, these people. They want to ruin our lives. They want to stop us making music, dancing, being happy. Of course they do.
Right.
And we have to, you know, stick to what we believe in, which is that life is to be lived.
We really need to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony.
Okay, so there is
by the world.
So there
coke.
Is there
keep
is
company.
There is truth to this. It's why. Hang on, listen to me here.
Okay,
listen carefully. Don't be a sloppy listener.
No, I'm not.
It's why we teach or taught in our military Christian war theory. Okay. We taught
which Obama stopped.
Yes, but that's what taught us to stop. You don't just go and slaughter. You don't use rage. You effectively stop the other side. And then you have compassion. And that's really important. So when he says we have to have compassion, yes, we do. And we should love our enemy. But we should also stand against evil just as we did with Nazi Germany. You could not have loved Hitler and the Gestapo out of the gas chambers. You couldn't do it. You had to violently stop him because some people won't be stopped by love. They don't understand it. They never will. That's why you stop the leadership. You cut the throat of all of those diehards, and then you immediately show compassion to those who might have been a little confused. And you show them, no, if you weren't a part of that, then we're okay. And we're going to work together. And we love you and we have compassion. And, you know, here, we're going to drop pallets of food so you can eat. If they don't get it, then I'm sorry. You start bombing us and killing people again, we're going to kill you. But you have to do it decisively, quickly, overwhelming. The only reason why Hitler stopped is because we were burning their cities down to the ground. The people said, I'm not standing with these guys. I can't stand with these guys. We're all going to be killed if these guys continue to go on. I'm not with them. You have to take the breath away from your enemy.
Yeah, and what if we had, instead of that, instead of meeting violence with violence during World War II, what if we had said, you know, let's be introspective here.
Chamberlain did
make them sign a peace treaty at the end of World War I, the Treaty of Versailles, that really pissed off the Germans. They have good reason to be angry with us. Let's go give them a hug.
But you know what? Let me tell you something.
We would have been killed. We would have been wiped from the face of the earth.
From the face of the earth. But let me tell you this. They did have reason. You can track the reasoning that brought Hitler to the forefront. You can track that in Germany. We treated them like garbage. And when I say we, America, Woodrow Wilson, treated them like garbage. And we gave them absolutely unreasonable terms that they could not live up to. And we humiliated them. Mm-hmm. So we didn't create Hitler. Hitler was already there saying things. We just helped create the conditions that grew Hitler. So we did play a role, but we didn't create him. It was already there. The people took to him because the conditions on the ground changed, but that didn't stop us from saying, oh my gosh, well, we helped create that. We fertilized that bed. We shouldn't do anything to stop it. No.
Yeah.
It's a noxious weed that will kill everything in the garden. Whether we fertilized it or not, you pull it up by the roots and you do it quickly.
So is extremism. Same thing.
Yes.
Same thing.
Yes.
I think what's frustrating, though, is that these things are the reflexive response from so many. Yeah. Yes, this is part of the conversation. I agree. However, the fact that you jump to after a terrorist attack, we need to make sure we're nicer and less racist, is a little frustrating.
Oh my gosh. And racist? Don't even start with me on racism.
But what will help is listening to Bono in a second.
We're going to get to that.
Play that.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Welcome to the program. Okay, so we heard from Brian May. Now let's hear what Bono said about the Manchester bombing.
As you know, there was another senseless terrorist attack in Manchester yesterday.
Obviously,
and
on Jimmy Kimmel.
That's something you guys have been thinking about.
They hate music. They hate women. They even hate little girls. They hate everything that we love. And, you know, the worst of humanity was on view in Manchester last night. But so was the best, as people took perfect strangers into their houses and queued up for blood banks, and Manchester has a undefeatable spirit, I can assure you.
Listen to the difference.
I mean, listen to the difference.
Awesome. Listen
between
to
him
the difference.
And Brian May. That almost sounds like what George Bush used to say all the time.
No, but
they hate
true.
Our music. They don't like Ariana Grande. They don't like our tunes. They hate freedom.
Right.
They don't like bowling. They don't like professional bowlers. They don't like the bowling shoes. They think they're ugly. Even the size 12, they don't like them at all. In fact, size 12 bowling shoes set them off more than anything else.
That's great.
There's more to Bono that you absolutely have to hear. One of the bravest.
Yeah.
One of the bravest. He's kind of the John Voight, though, of music. John Voight's like, I got my Oscars. They don't know what to do with me now anyway. I'm going to still act in all their movies because they love me. That's who he is. Bono is John Voight of music.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program.
All right, so let's play the Manchester from Jimmy Kimmel and Bono. I think Bono is an amazing guy, truly an amazing guy. And I don't know if he has changed, if he was as lefty as we thought, or if he was just so popular, the left just brought him in and said, oh, Bono, you're so great, and you agree with us on everything. And he got credit for and blame for things that he really didn't believe. I don't know.
Possibly. Because I remember disliking him a lot, thinking he was a wacko.
Well, you were a big
progressive
U2 fan.
I am still a big U2 fan. Actually, seeing them on Friday here in
Dallas.
Are you really? Yeah, they're doing it.
I've never seen them. I'd love
they're fantastic.
To see them.
This one is the Joshua Tree tour, so they're going back. I can't remember.
What?
I guess it's the 30-year anniversary of the Joshua Tree, so they're doing the whole album. And I think just that.
If they're playing anywhere when I get back from vacation, if they're anywhere close, let's all go as a show. I'd love to see them. I've never seen them. I hear they're great.
They are. I've been a big fan for a really long time. But I've always felt that the right gave him an unfair shake when it comes to who he is, because he's seen as sort of this crazy liberal activist. And like he was big on, you know, supporting AIDS charities and debt relief and sort of these global causes that you'd associate with every left wing annoying
AIDS
right.
For Africa.
Celebrity.
And there's
of
nothing,
course, we
and
all believe.
Nothing. There's nothing wrong with any of that.
Of course not. No,
I always just assumed that he was with the United Nations, and I think he was.
Yeah,
and then he saw that it didn't work.
Yeah, and he's, you know, I think he's no hardcore conservative by any means.
No.
But he's always been a big capitalist, and I think he's always been religious, and mm-hmm. and had a really impassioned.
And he's not afraid to talk about it.
He was always religious.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the beginnings of the band, I mean, I think he's had times where he's had his ups and downs. Like, he's lived a life, you know? I mean, he's lived a rock star life, too.
I just never have not heard, I've heard him mention Jesus a lot lately.
Yeah.
I mean, he must be one of his up periods, because nobody uses the J word.
Yeah, he's been more outspoken, I think, recently. But he's always had that influence. And, like, you know, one of the things he got beat up on was this Red project he did.
Yeah.
Now, the Red project was, you might remember it, it was all shirts, and a lot of people and celebrities were wearing them for a while.
Yeah.
And it said, like, inspired, and Red was in parentheses, and it raised money for global charities, and it was a big deal. And, you know, the media, and also a lot on the right, kind of jumped on him, was like, well, here you go. I think they raised $100 million or something, and they... But, like, you know, I can't remember exactly what it was. It was something like at the end of one period, they'd only sent something like $20 million to these charities. And it's like, well, think about what he did there from a conservative perspective for a moment.
Right.
He worked with dozens of actual stores. He didn't just ask for free money. He worked with actual capitalist institutions, designed clothing that people wanted to wear, and then took a chunk of that money and gave 20%. It to charity. It was something like 20% that he gave to charity. Now, it didn't give every dime of it to charity. There were licensing fees that they paid, and he got criticism for that. And the fact that they were working through these big companies that only want profit and get people in the stores and they buy other things.
You had to have license or people would rip it off and then you would just have nothing.
Exactly. And here's a guy who actually worked through capitalism to improve the world.
That's why.
And isn't that good? And that's why he got beat up by places like the New York Times. But the right jumped on it because it was
so
it's a
weird
celebrity.
That you'd say that because I almost said when he started his red campaign, I almost said that's when I started to like him. And I thought maybe it wasn't. I don't know when, but it was around that period that I started to think. I think this guy gets it.
Yeah, and he's like you would talk to I'm sure Bono about a million topics, and you'd disagree on half of them probably. He's not like he's no libertarian.
Right, and you're a huge fan of his.
I'm
right?
a huge fan.
Right, you remember the time when I met him and spent like a half hour with him? We just chatted.
In New York when he was doing the.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah, remember you weren't there, but I just chatted with him. We're buds.
Yeah, it seems like you didn't even know who he was.
I knew he was part of U2, but I'd never seen any of his concerts or anything like that.
He was asking you advice.
This is what's important.
Yeah, he was. He was asking me advice.
Curing deadly diseases, and this is what you're going to focus on.
Only because it drives you out of your mind.
It does.
So listen to this from Bono. This came out earlier this week.
My mother died at her own father's graveside as he was being lowered into the ground. She had an aneurysm. I was 14. She left me. But she left me an artist. I began the journey, trying to fill the hole in my heart with music, with my mates, my bandmates. And finally, the only thing that can fill it is God's love. And it's a big hole, but luckily, there's a big love. I went finally to Jerusalem on a family pilgrimage. Wow. And I went to Golgotha. And I went to the site where, and I had some time on my own, where death died. And I was like, wow, there it is. That's where death died. And so, I don't really believe in it.
Wow.
That's unbelievable. From
a rock star?
I've never heard it described as where death died. That is fantastic.
Like, he speaks in lyrics in normal conversation. Yeah,
I noticed that when I was... Oh, you weren't there.
No, I wasn't.
Oh,
I was not there. No, I was not.
He's almost poetic.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
a lot like Donald Trump, who is also so eloquent that sometimes shoots right over your head.
If I may quote, what's her name? The country artist, the young girl that remember, I saw the 100 most important people in the world or influential people in the world thing. She got up in front of Elton John and said, I have this theory that songs, love songs, are just poetry set to music.
It was so profound, wasn't it?
So profound. Remember who is it? She's the big, I actually like her. She's the big country artist that really respect her for, the way she treats her fans and everything.
What's Taylor Swift?
Taylor Swift, yeah. Elton John was sitting right in front of her.
He'd probably never heard that before.
And he had never heard that before. I think he put his head in his hands.
Yes,
that point. He's like, oh, dear God. But she didn't say it to a crowd of influential or important people at all. That was a good thing.
That's good. Right. Yeah. U2's 1983 album, War, has a song called 40. Here's the quote. This is by The Edge, not Bono, the other guy in the band. One of the other guys in the band talking about what it came from. So when we had this slightly unusual piece of music and we said, okay, what are we going to do with it? Bono said, let's do a psalm. Opened up the Bible and found Psalm 40. This is it. Let's do it. The song title is 40. Within 40 minutes, we had worked out the last few elements for the tune. Bono had sung it. We had mixed it. And literally after finishing the mix, we walked out through the door and the next band walked in. But I mean, they did a song that was based on Psalm 40. One of their CDs. And this is 1983. This is not a new thing, obviously. So, I mean, they've always been...
So is he
real
Catholic?
I think he is, yeah.
Yeah.
Is it Scotland that is one of it? Is the struggle only in Ireland between the Catholics and the Protestants?
Yeah, I don't think it's in Scotland.
Why not? Aren't they like right next door to each other? Aren't they like
are,
a stone's throw away?
Let's lead it
can't
to
you
our...
throw a Molotov cocktail from Ireland to Scotland?
Copycat protests.
You don't think so?
I don't think so.
Because I think they're basically the same country.
Let's leave it to the expert on this debate, Jeffy. Jeffy, what? How would you describe that?
Describe what?
Yeah, okay. That's my new thing is whenever there's a complicated topic, I just throw it to Jeffy as the expert
right.
because then he looks dumb instead of me.
Good. And then you get something really deep like...
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program.
I'm so glad that you've tuned in today. Thank you so much. For putting up with us as we try to figure out the world just as much as you are and trying to find our way in this crazy, chaotic world with all the things that are going on. I don't know if you saw this, but I want to warn you that what I said before they lost Bill O'Reilly was... You know, when you lose Bill O'Reilly, they're going to go after everybody else. And next on the hit list will be Sean Hannity. And it looks like that is beginning to happen. I hope not, too. I mean, it you will lose Fox and everything that Fox has done or has meant, good or bad. And I think you already have lost it. They were number three in primetime last
week. That's the first
right.
time. For, number three in the demo, which is the important statistic, yeah. 25 to 54-year-olds.
And number two...
For the first time in 17 years. 17. 17 years!
I mean, think of those coincidence,
think of those,
right?
Think of those promos that Bill O'Reilly used to... 17 years at number one.
I mean, it's the first time this century that it's happened. Think about that. And they were number two overall. So they lost in the demo, and they lost to MSNBC in the overall numbers, which never happened.
I just wish there was a place where we could hear what Bill O'Reilly's thinking about.
Oh,
right
my
now.
Gosh.
Right?
Friday, he's going to be on... Well, this show.
On this show?
This show.
On Friday?
What a coincidence that you would think of that,
it's happening,
place.
And it's here.
That's incredible.
That is nuts.
What are the odds that you would even bring that up?
Probably 1-1.
Probably.
You know? Right. Man, I would have liked to put money on those odds.
I know. I would have returned it to you.
I would have put $1,000 on it. I would have gotten $1,000 back.
That's incredible.
That doesn't happen every day.
No, so. It sure doesn't.
I would have guessed it was 0-1 odds.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
You
0-1.
Because yeah.
So anyway, yeah. sincerely, you know, I said this earlier today, and. As I said it, I felt I need to start saying this more often. Remember when I used to say all the time, what you think is solid will be liquid, and what you think is liquid will be solid, and...
Up is down, down is up.
Yeah, and everything will be... You won't know what to trust. Well, we're here. What I said this morning, and as soon as I started to say it, I thought, boy, I need to start saying this every day. The world that you wake up on a Monday morning... That world will not be the same on a Friday. I believe change so profound is possible that you wake up on a Monday and everything's fine. Something happens that week that the entire world is inside out by Friday. I hope that doesn't happen, but I felt that. Strongly this morning.
Well, that's a fun thought. Thank you.
Thank you for that.
Good morning, everybody.
Well, we have saved that for Friday, so you could have chewed on that. Should have chewed on that all through the weekend.
Yeah. Now, you think that's because of a terror strike or?
No, I just think that we are so close to we're like, I don't know, my father is a baker and he used to make rum cake. And it just soaked in rum. I feel like the entire world is soaking in gasoline. And it's just everything, it just permeates with some flammable liquid.
A spark will set the entire thing on fire. And, you know, North Korea, just, I mean...
A lot of people trying to have that spark happen around the globe.
Let's say the terrorists collapse the London stock market for some reason. They do something, and they collapse the London stock market. That will collapse our stock market. That'll collapse Europe's stock market. It'll cascade. And then what do you have? By Friday, your banks are closed, and you got lockdown of everything. You know, they do a Beslin attack in the United States. They kill our children. That's not going to go well. North Korea just announced yesterday they are now starting an assembly line production of missiles, of medium-range missiles. We've already said that you can't have missiles that can reach out and touch us. They just had one that could reach Hawaii. And now they're starting a production line on it? I think we go into a Cold War on that.
So you were thinking all this morning?
I was.
You know, it's a surprise that Tanya wants to leave the house and go to the gym in the morning.
Before I wake up. She just wakes me up and runs.
Hey, honey.
Gotta go!
Thank you, Jeffy. You're welcome. Appreciate that. Thank you. No.
But the terrorists would do that because they hate our freedom.
Yeah, that's right.
They hate our liberty.
Yes.
They hate our, what they hate is our tunes. The song, Call Me Maybe, they don't like it.
Right.
They don't like it. They want to kill us because of it.
Call Me, because of Call Me Maybe. Arlie really. Ray.
Something in the Jepson? Koran about not calling people maybe. You either do it or you don't.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't read that part, but you've read the Koran.
Yes, it's Quatrain 12. In the Quran.
No, I don't think quatrains were that was Nostradamus.
Yes, it's the same book, just a different chapter.
The Nostradamus chapter of the Quran?
I didn't know that he wrote for the Quran, too.
You don't know a lot of things, Glenn. That's why I was president.
Yeah, it sounds a little like something that people get killed for saying.
I didn't say it. That's why I'm wondering why you did.
All right, we'll see you at 5 o'clock on the Blaze TV. You can sign up and watch us, blaze.com/TV.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.